Hey friend, welcome back to the Old Fashioned On Purpose podcast. So I have a repeat guest today. He was so good the first time, I had to have him back. We're talking about a slightly different topic. Last time he was here, we talked about pastured pork. You probably know who I'm talking about, the one and only Charles Mayfield. And I got so much positive feedback, and he's so easy to talk to, honestly, that I wanted to have him back to take a slightly different angle. Today, we're going to still be talking about pigs, but we're going to talk about next steps. Last time we talked about how to raise the pork sustainably. And if you haven't heard that episode, go ahead and listen to that one. We'll drop the number and all the info in the show notes. And then today we're talking about, okay, you've raised the pigs. What do you do next? Do you butcher at home? How to find a good butcher? And then we're going to dive into potentially my favorite part of these topics, and that is lard, rendering lard, differences in lard, lard breeds of pigs, all the lard. So Charles, welcome back. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Fantastic to be back with you, Jill. This is a lot of fun. I enjoyed our last conversation, looking to take it to the next level.
Yes. So I think most people have heard that previous episode. They know you're a regenerative farming evangelist. I love that title, by the way. You're the founder of Faro Skincare. You're a farmer. But in case they haven't listened to that one, can you just give us a quick intro of kind of your background and why you're so passionate about this topic?
Sure. So yes, I was first introduced to regenerative farming in 2012. Took a pilgrimage to Polyface Farms in Virginia. This was sort of through the paleo community. My ex-wife and I had just published our first cookbook. You know, Faro is really like cookbook meets gym meets farm meets skincare. And so, yeah, I was just, the hooks went in deep. And so, as you may know, Joel's a prolific writer. And so just started consuming as much of his material as possible. In 2016, moved up to Tennessee, where I was born and raised, to start farming, and got into, I would call it a micro polyface model. We were raising pasture beef, pork, chicken, eggs, and did that from 2016 and until very recently. So hung the farmer hat up in December, just not enough time in the day. But yeah, it was farming and just getting connected with the land and the animals. And stumbled upon lard as a skincare ingredient in 2019, and have never looked back. We launched the company in 2022, and I love being an evangelical regenerative farmer. I think it solves a lot of the problems that that plague our modern world today. You know, whether it's climate change or just general human health, and certainly our ecology. And so Faro is really a consumer brand propped up and supported by a foundation of raising animals in line with nature and building soil. And so, yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
So many good things there, just right up the alley of our listeners, I know. And yeah, I've been using I told you this before we hit record, but I want the audience to know, I've been using some of your skincare since our last interview, and I really like it. Like it's amazing. I used it this morning. In fact, like it's so good. And I love every time I put it on, I know that I'm not dealing with, you know, all the junk that's coming in. So many of the other face cream skincare. So it's good stuff, guys. We'll talk a little bit more about that at the end, but it's really good. I can attest. And he's not paying me to say that, FYI. So,
thank you. Thank you. We're very proud of our products. We don't have a lot of SKUs. You know, it's a little goes a long way. But yeah, no, it's always fun to hear people talk about how much they love the lard in their life. So
yes, thank you. Yes, I like that. Okay. So last time it was all things pastured pork. I had some great revelations on that episode. A lot of good info. Today we're talking next steps. So the pork has been pastured. It is ready. Now we are going to process said pork. What do people need to know when they're at this point in the process? How, like maybe to start off, how do we know when we're ready to butcher these animals? I know there's certain weights that people talk about, but a lot of homesteaders mm-hmm. don't have scales at home. So how would you recommend they kind of ballpark that?
Yeah. So a good general ballparking rule is about 8 months from birth. you'll have a market weight pig. And I define that as, you know, probably 300 pound live weight, maybe a little heavier, maybe a little lighter, but I think that's a good target for what I would deem a market weight pig. Now you can harvest them certainly sooner than that, but 8 months, and that's a good general rule across most breeds. You know, your Cooney Coonies are going to be a little smaller. I've never worked with Cooney Coonies, but yeah. I mean, as a general rule of thumb, I would say a standard market breed, even heritage breeds, you know, we can talk about Mangalitzas, Old Spots, Red Wattles, Duroks, across the board, 8 months is a good target. And, you know, I know we talked last time, Jill, about, especially at the homesteader level, that one of the nice things about a pig is you can take it from birth to market weight in under a year. And so get them in the spring, harvest them in the fall when it's cooler outside. And so, yeah, I think 8 months is a good target for anybody.
Okay. It's a good rule of thumb. So I think one of the biggest concerns for any homesteader raising meat animals, whether it's chicken, pork, beef, is butchering day. Not only just the emotions that can come with that or sometimes that trepidation, but it's a big undertaking. Even butchering chickens can feel formidable, especially when we get into these larger animals. It's a process. And if you've never butchered something before, it's a little bit intimidating. So how would you coach someone through, you know, the decision of, do I butcher myself or do I try to outsource that?
Sure. So, you know, the first easy question to ask are, is there a butcher, you know, within reasonable proximity to my land? The nice thing about pigs is you can repurpose a landscape trailer. You know, most homesteaders have some form of trailer. And I never used a livestock trailer in the history of my pigs. We would always just fashion up a little gate and walls of like hog wire or even cattle panels around. Just think about a regular landscape trailer. And by the time the pigs are that old, you know, they're docile, you know, they know who you are and they don't get too nervous. And so transport's not difficult. You don't have to have a livestock trailer. You know, depending on what you want out of the pig, the one thing with a pig that is unique versus, say, a cow or even a sheep or goat is if you're going to do any curing, especially of the hams, then you're going to want the skin on. And so a question to ask, let's just say you've got a butcher, you know, within a reasonable distance, do they scald and scrape? Okay. That is the process. That's the name for, you know, you heat the skin up with hot water on a pig and you scrape the hair off. And so that way you can leave the skin on. We could talk about some strategies for that at home, but that would be a big question for me if I were taking, you know, I've got three butchers within 2 hours of me that all do pigs, and two of the three will scald and scrape. And so depending on what I want to do with the pig, really and truly around the hams, and this gets into the uniqueness of the pig in terms of, you know, you raise them this year, but you're eating them next year and the year after and the year after that, because you can cure and smoke and hang those hams in you know, non-temperature regulated, you know, hell, hang them in a barn. Yep. And so, yeah, I would say that a good rule of thumb for your listeners is the day you bring the pigs home is the day you start looking for butchers, because you're going to want to go talk to them. I would even do a site visit. You know, is the facility clean? Do the employees, are they good people? Similar to how you treat a farmer, you know, just go shake their hand, talk through their process. I did have some early nightmarish stories in trying to find a good quality butcher. But outside of that, I think you can get a lot done with just Googling around and talking to other farmers. You know, if there's another homesteader or somebody else raising pigs in your area, ask them. I mean, it's a good community, and if there's a good pig butcherer out there, you'll want to know who they are. And so, yeah, that's one side of the coin. We need to talk about if you want to butcher at home. This is one of the great things about pigs. They're not as big as a cow. Now, again, market weight, 300 pounds. That's a lot of, that's a lot of animal to, you're not going to throw them over your shoulder like a goat or a sheep. Yeah. And so as long as you've got like a deer processing sort of setup, I think you can handle pigs just fine. But the scalding's great. That's what we got to talk about. So, again, for your listeners that aren't familiar, you heat a bunch of water up. I would do some Googling on this. I've heard everything from the water's got to be 140 degrees to 160 degrees. I think all of that varies depending on your elevation and all sorts of stuff like that. I think putting a little soap, like a dish soap in the water, helps break the surface tension. But yeah, you're going to want to, again, if you can skin the hog, you can skin the whole thing out. You're just left with the meat, which is fine. Then you're cutting up those hams or doing whatever you want with them. But if curing is in your lexicon of curiosity, then I would strongly encourage you to prepare yourself to do some scalding and scraping. I've seen it done with just, so think about a big pot of water and some old kitchen towels. And so you put the towels over the pig and you pour the water on, and it's not more than a couple minutes worth of hot soaking. And then the real work starts, you know, and you know, just like with the raising of pigs, I think I mentioned, you know, buy a feeder, buy a waterer. Don't try and make these things on your own. Like pigs are very destructive. I would say when it comes to scalding and scraping, it's $15 maybe, but go buy a Bell scraper. You can find them on Amazon. I'm sure you can find them in other places, but get you a couple of real pig scrapers. And so, yeah, that's the number one concern at home. I mean, skinning and eviscerating is the easy way out, but you're going to lose the ability to cure some of that meat.
So you can't cure it. If the skin is gone, you're not going to be able to cure.
No, I'm sorry. No, you can still cure a whole bunch of stuff on the hog,
but not the ham.
But keeping the ham. Yeah, well, again, I've learned bad experience. I've tried curing skinless hams, and they cure, but they dry out immediately. Like it's the shelf life of a skinned cured ham is not very long. You got to think about this super protective layer, you know, impenetrable really layer of skin. And of course you've got the open end where all the meat is showing through, but you salt all that really heavily. And yes, now having said that, you know, if you want to go through the, so this is the nice thing. If you're just interested in curing, say the hams, right? Well, you can just scald and scrape. So we'll back up in a minute and talk about killing the hog. But you can just scald and scrape, especially with the towel method, the hams, like the, you know, the lower extremities of the pig, and then you can skin the rest out, right? So you've got some options. Scalding and scraping the head is precarious work, but it's also worth it because you can, you know, if you go deep down, you can do like a porchetta di testa. You know, you can debone the whole head and tongue and wrap all that up. And I mean, it's the best in the world. It's just a lot of work, but
sure,
the skin on the hams is important.
Okay. That's great advice. As I know, I think a lot of people aren't going to think of that, especially even if they're going to a butcher, they're just not going to be thinking to request that. Do you find, or do you have a feel of how many butchers do the scalding and scrape? Is that a rare thing to find, or is it kind of 50-50? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I would say it's probably not 50-50. It's I would say fewer.
Okay.
But it depends. I mean, again, I'm fortunate. I mentioned two of the three will scald and scrape, but one of the two that scald and scrapes, like, you've got to make an appointment way in advance because that they don't do that for all pigs, and so the slots aren't as numerous. But again, this gets back to the day you bring the pigs home, start making calls and planning it out. You know, as it relates to, we're not going to go to the butcher, we're going to do this at home. They're a very easy animal. Again, a little feed on the ground, you know, get them to the spot I can't wait for your listeners to play with pigs, because again, by the time we get here, it's just a little can of corn shaking it, and that pig will follow you anywhere you want to go. People lose their minds when we start talking about leading an animal into for that one bad day.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're happy as a lark all the way up to the minute you put a bullet in the back of their head, which is my preferred method of kill. Okay. Some people like to go through the top of the head. I like to be behind the pig. So imagine, you know, you've got some food scraps or something, you put them on the ground, they're eating them. You come right in behind the ear, and, you know, this is not a job for a 22. Yes. You know, I'd say 32 is the minimum caliber you ought to use, but I use a 9mm as my preferred weapon. And one to the back of the head, and then I would have a knife handy. You want to immediately get into the jugular after you've shot the pig, and cut that vein to start draining the blood. So to walk through the process, it's bang, cut, and then if we're going to be doing some scalding and scraping, you know, you already have your water heated, all of that's ready to go, you know, okay. And hopefully proximate. And so you get into the whole scald and scrape. So get them wet and start scraping the hair off. And then at some point you're done, whether that's a full body scald and scrape or not. It's also handy to have a blowtorch of sorts. Mm. It doesn't have to be a big blowtorch, but sort of down to the end, you'll find some hairs that are just rampant and you can't sort of scrape them off. And so a lot of times they'll quick run up a torch over and just burn the hair off.
Okay.
Is a good strategy. But yeah, and then once you've gotten your hair off, you string them up just like you would a deer or any other carcass and eviscerate them.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask you, because I was always picturing scalding after the evisceration, but you're saying do that immediately after you cut the jugular, and then yeah, okay.
It's an important point to bring up is other than the jugular puncture to drain the blood, you're not putting any more, you're not cutting any blemishes in the body. Because if you did, again, this water's really hot, you're going to end up cooking. Yeah. Yeah, the meat. And so you've got some time to do it. I mean, I've done this before, you know, just a sort of a hand scald and scrape. If you've got an Amish farm anywhere within, you know, first of all, you should go see them anyway, if they take visitors, but oftentimes if they're raising pigs, they're doing this. And so for your listeners, that might be a good step one before you even jump into the game, just go watch somebody else do it. Or ask for their help, you know, maybe they'll come over and help you, but yes, you want to keep the skin intact, until you're done with whatever degree of scald and scrape that you're wanting to achieve, and then string them up, cut them open and eviscerate.
Okay. So the few times we have processed our own pigs, right now we take them to the butcher cause we have a good local butcher, but, we just skinned them. Cause I just assumed the scalding, I had to have like a giant barrel. Now that I say that, I'm like, that sounds ridiculous, but I didn't realize you could just do it with towels and hot water. So this is enlightening to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple ways to do it. I mean, so I'll tell you three ways. One is the lots of water, you know, hot. I like to get the water a little hotter than they tell you it needs to be. But again, this is where local knowledge, elevation, all of those, you know, it's just like baking cakes, you know, everybody, it's 42 minutes in the oven at 350 versus 47, right? Yeah. So local knowledge is helpful. I'm sure there's some chat rooms and Facebook groups and all this out there for such things. But yeah, so the towel method works great, especially if you're just going to do the hams. Like you think about the middle of your back down. That's all you're going to scrape the hair off of. Then beyond that, the two methods I've seen, if you've got a tractor or some way to really pick this animal up and down, then, you know, 55-gallon drum over a fire, and you fill the drum about halfway with water. Don't fill it all the way up, because you put the pig in and all of a sudden you put your fire out, and you dip, you know, one end of the pig in, and then you flip it over and you dip the other end of the pig in, and you can be scraping while, you know, while that's going on. And then the other method I've seen, which is the one I've actually done, is they took that 55 gallon barrel and they cut it in half lengthwise and laid it down on its side. And so you're rolling the pig in this 55 gallon barrel. Depends on the size of the pig. Again, you know, if it's a full market weight size pig, you're going to be hard pressed with that method, just because there's not as much room in there as you'd like. But yeah, those are the three ways that I've seen it done or done it myself. But again, the towel is highly effective.
Yeah. And I'm just picturing, I mean, wrestling a pig around trying to get it in hot scalding water. I mean, that's, you're going to have some major equipment. I mean, that's just a lot more cumbersome. So I feel like the towel method for a homesteader is just the way to go.
It works pretty well. Yeah. I've seen it and I've done it and it works. And so, and you know, you put the towel on, you wet it, you pour some more, you know, you have your pot. And so you're dipping out of a big pot and you're just pouring it over these towels. And, again, the dish soap is a big one. That surface tension break. Same if you're scalding chickens.
Yes,
put a little dish soap in your it gets all the way down to the skin, which is what you want.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And the whole time you've been talking about this, I mean, I scald her. I'm the one who always scalds the chickens, and I'm just 145, and I have the feel, like you said, local knowledge and just the feel. You just got to do it a couple times, but it's not difficult once you have the hang of it. Just like with anything.
I mean, you're also speaking to sort of the pressure we put on ourselves, right? If I'm doing 10 chickens, you got the first one to learn on, and then you've got nine more that you can get right. You know, with the pig, it's sort of like one and done. And so, I recommend research, and local knowledge if you can find it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good formula for so many things. So you mentioned, you know, curing. Obviously, we're getting the hair off so we can cure. Do you recommend that folks cure at home generally, or finding butchers to do that? And if you do find a butcher who cures, do you have things that you look for or things you avoid in butcher methods?
Okay. So, well, you got two things there. You got butchering and then you got curing.
Okay.
This is my Bible. You can see I got a bunch of pages marked in here. This is Curing and Smoking Made at Home. This is, can I mention the author?
Yes, please.
Yeah, this is Dick and James Strawbridge. I've had this book for a number of years. And it's a fantastic, fantastic reference guide. Okay. And then Ryan Farr's book, this is This Whole Beast Butchery.
That one looks really good.
Okay. Oh, this is it covers pigs. It covers a number of different red meat species.
Okay.
So those are my two great go-to reference guides. Again, there's a million of them out there. These are just two that I've sort of settled on so you got butchering, which is how do you want the pig cut up?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got curing, which is they're related because you want a certain cut, like the copa, for example, out of the shoulder. If you want to cure it, then you need it to be whole. And then there's all, you know, how much grind do you want? If you've got, again, this goes back to the go and shake their hand, but if you've got a good butcher that will cure, and again, conversationally, like, what will you do? Is it can you just cure bacon? You don't see it much, Jill, just because you'll see a little bit more in the state inspection side, but from a USDA standpoint, it's an added layer. It's an added HACCP plan. So a lot of butchers will not cure or smoke because it's another layer of government regulation they have to abide by food safety and all that fun stuff. So I do recommend, here's a nice middle ground. Get your butcher to cut things the way you want. For example, a whole belly, right? Get them to give you the whole belly. Then you can block it and cut it in half. You know, a whole belly is a big piece of meat, right?
Yes.
And so if you want to play around with bacon, my suggestion is have the butcher, if it goes to a butcher, have the butcher cut the belly out and you get the belly and then you do your own curing and smoking and various things. So you can marry the two together. But if the butcher doesn't exist, you know, having a home grinder, I love hand crank grinders, but of course every mixer on the planet's got a meat grinder attachment these days. And then you just get your sausage stuffing. And so you can make sausage or you can make cured sausage. I mean, the options are limitless. Now with the hams, and then again, this is back to why you keep the skin on. If you want hams, I would suggest it. You should totally, there's two hams. So at the very least, take one, cure it, smoke it, hang it in a barn somewhere. You can grind the other ham. Back when I was producing a lot of pork, I would, there was nothing I did with the hams other than if they were scalded, scraped and skin on, they go to the cure. I do have someone locally that was able to do that for me. But if not, they were ground. And so I'd turn that whole ham into sausage, you know, ground pork, whatever.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have thoughts on, I know you're referencing the dry cure method with your smoking, your salting, your hanging. What are your thoughts on dry versus wet? Cause I've just played with sometimes I'll take a pork shoulder or a smaller fresh ham and I'll just do a wet brine for, 5-10 days in the fridge. What would you say to people who are trying to figure out the differences and sort out which one is better, or maybe they're not better, just
sure.
Different.
Yeah. They're both great. I think the wet brining and wet curing, I'm not a pro. I'm a amateur at best, but I think that's more of an immediate situation. So if I want to eat this piece of meat in the next week or two, then you can look at some. I mean, the advantage to the dry curing is the shelf life of that meat is substantially longer.
Yes,
you know, your salamis and all of those things. I mean, look at the front of the book, it's just hanging around. And once it's cured and dried, I think we talked about it in the last podcast. I still have them. I've got one hanging in my garage right now. These hams that are just 2, 3, 4 years old.
Yeah.
And, you cut them open and it's just magical how good it tastes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say explore it all. You know, don't get overwhelmed. Everybody wants to get overwhelmed. So if you want to explore both, pick a wet curing recipe, and pick a couple dry curing recipes and go from there.
Yeah. Do you ever have people wonder if you're a serial killer when you have hams hanging in your garage?
No.
Okay,
no.
Good. just thought I'd ask.
Now who knows what they say when they leave. Okay. But it's a good way to keep strangers out.
That's true.
Just
that's
have
true.
A couple of, yes. Have a couple of moldy, nasty looking hams hanging in your garage. Yep. And for your listeners that don't know, flies don't go anywhere near it. Nothing goes. It's the most amazing thing. Once it's cured, everything's hermetically sealed. Now it'll get moldy, nasty. It'll look like something you'd never want to touch. And you just...
Yeah.
When it comes time, when that day comes and you are ready to eat your ham, get your white vinegar and a little water and scrub brush and scrape it off and give it one day to dry back out and then get to slicing.
Yes. It's funny how those of us in this world, this homestead whole food world, I was thinking about the other day because I was around someone who was super hyper focused on, this has the teeniest bit of mold on it. I can't eat it. It was cheese, right? Huh. And I'm used to my home cured cheeses will get mold on the outside and their little vacuum seal. And I'm like, cut it off, kids. Let's break it open. And it's just, you just lose your aversion to that so quickly. Once you start to understand whole foods and the processes, it's funny. Just scrape that mold off that ham. It's good. But I mean, that feels so normal to you. And I think someone listening who wasn't, immersed in the world would be horrified at this moment. I mean, I think we already probably horrified. Go ahead.
Isn't penicillin derived from mold?
Yeah. 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 And blue cheese so many of these foods. I'm like, why are you all so scared of mold?
Fermentation is, you could almost make the argument that fermentation co-evolved with humans.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back as far. Part of this is the germ theory and where everybody's afraid of being. Yes, you should always be consuming a little bit of microbial nastiness.
Yep.
It's the key to health.
Yes. Yes. And once you start to understand the process of so many of these foods, whether it's like the curing or the fermentation or the cheese, I'm like, it's a process of breaking down that makes it so delicious. Yeah. You know, we think that that's instantly bad, and it's not.
Yeah. I have found, kefir. Okay. Yes. Kombucha actually is a better example because that's a little bit more commercially, you know, everyone knows what kombucha is. And apple cider vinegar, those two. I think that's a good bridge thing to talk about with people that are just completely skeeved out because those are fermented, you know, mass marketed items, yes. Apple cider vinegar and kombucha. So sauerkraut for crying out loud.
Right. Yeah, totally. So. Yeah. It's just funny. I think once you kind of start going down the road, you get converted pretty quickly, but it's always funny when you have the uninitiated. They're like, yeah. What is the body bless part floating in the jar? I'm like, it's a kombucha SCOBY. And then it's just like, whoo, mind blown. So yeah. And it's not a body part, but it looks like one. It's not an organ, I promise.
It looks like the jars from the Star Wars movie when they go in the bar, you know, and they got all those.
Yeah. Yep. All the stuff. Yeah. It's funny. Okay. So I want to, before we switch over to more of a deep dive on lard, is there anything else you wanted to add about the home butchering process?
Yeah. So, well, it's a really good segue. Okay. So again, back to, it's going to depend on whether or not you've scalded and scraped your entire animal. But let's go with the halvesies model real quick, and then people can dial up or down from there. So you scald and scrape the bottom half, so you got whole hams. You're going to skin out the rest. And so, you know, you eviscerate. Now, to whatever degree, I haven't gone down deep in this wormhole yet, but, you know, you got the liver in there, you got the kidneys, you've got the intestines. You know, if you want to pull the intestines out and empty them out, you've got chitlins, and I don't rock chitlins, to each their own, but you've got some glands in there. You've obviously got the heart. These are all things that you want to save, and use. You've also got the kidney fat. Okay. So as you're eviscerating, the good news about the kidney fat is, you know, you're a first timer, you cut them open, all the guts spill out on the ground. Well, again, I would tell you, pick all the stuff up you want, wash it off. You're fine. But the kidney fat's going to actually cling inside to the carcass. It's visceral, but it's stuck inside. Yes. So you're going to want to with the kidney fat, you want to cool the animal off. This again speaks to sort of the seasonality of pork. If you don't have a walk-in cooler or anything like that, I would suggest once you've scalded and scraped and eviscerated, if it's cold enough in the winter, or you have a deer hunting cooler or something you can hang it in, I would recommend giving it a day to, you know, really come down to temperature. You want to get the carcass cool as quickly as possible. So this is, again, one of the reasons why we kill hogs in the winter. So nice cool morning. That's probably another thing to help you plan your butchering day, again, on the homestead, is let's just make sure it's going to be nice and cool. And so the reason you want to do that is that fat will harden up. Even the subcutaneous fat will all harden up. It'll make butchering a lot easier. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't age pork like you do beef, you know, you hang or deer or anything like that. So as soon as it comes to temp, it's time to get going. But yeah, I would pay particular attention during evisceration to the organs, pull out what you want, probably save a few things you don't think you want, you know, especially if you have dogs, and everything else can go into compost heap. You know, that's, you know, save all the blood. If you're crazy aficionado, get some of the blood at the very get go, like save a bunch of blood. I've heard of people making ice. So apparently pig's blood has the same qualities as egg yolks in terms of like, like I've had pig's blood ice cream before.
Okay.
And it was absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
Even knowing it was pig's blood ice cream, I found it absolutely delicious, but there's a lot of things you can do with the blood as well. So you might, you know, again, just sort of going backwards here, you might want to reserve some of the blood you know, bang, cut, reserve, and, you know, you can make blood meal, all sorts of stuff, out of that. But yeah, I think we sort of covered it. The cooling off will help the harvesting of the kidney fat, the leaf fat on a pig. It'll make that easier. And it'll also stiffen everything up. It'll make the muscle cutting a little bit easier. And again, if this was done in a butcher at a slaughterhouse, that is exactly what they would do. They would kill the animal. If they're going to scald and scrape it, eviscerate it, and then hang it in a cooler overnight and let it cool off. Because you do want to get that hog, any animal, you want to get them within 24 hours, but especially hogs, you want to get them to, you know, 40 degrees or less.
Yes. Yes. And I know that was one of our biggest challenges here was, well, that's why we stopped butchering our own beef. And obviously we couldn't sell our beef anyway. If we had butchered it here, it has to be USDA certified, but like just the hanging process of beef and getting it cold fast enough was such a challenge. And even with pigs, like you said, it can be tricky just watching the weather and you get your crew to help you. But then if it's hot, you have to, you know, divert your calendar. So I think that's one of the trickiest parts. It's not hard. You just have to coordinate.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. How the hell did we survive 200 years ago?
I know. I know. I think we overthink so much now. But yeah, it's incredible. They didn't have tractors to hoist it up or coolers and all the things. So, yeah.
Hey, friend, I'm interrupting this episode for just a second to give a shout out to our sponsor, Genuine Beef. Now, this is actually my beef company, the one that my husband and I started a number of years ago to bring our grass-finished Wyoming beef straight to your doorstep. And I know that whenever we start to shift into this fall and winter season, I get the very primal urge to stock up on food. And I know many of you feel that same way. So we have put together a freezer filler special to help you do just that. You're going to get four of our most popular beef roasts, the ones that are great for crock pots and those cozy winter meals, as well as 3 pounds of our 90/10 ground beef. We're going to put it all in a bundle and give it to you for 15% off while supplies last. Now, we can ship this to anywhere in the continental U.S. We do second day air. We put a lot of dry ice in there, so it'll get to your doorstep safe and sound. And if you want to grab a box or two or three, head on over to theprairiehomestead.com/freezer to grab your bundle. And I'll go ahead and drop that link in the show notes, too. Now, back to our episode.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, so we have our pig hanging. We have our kidney fat up in the carcass. And I think we talked about this last time, but I want to talk about it briefly again because I think it's a really important differentiation. There are breeds of pigs that are for lard production, and there are more meat breeds. And this was a huge, very disappointing revelation the first time we butchered because I had no idea there was a difference. I had buckets ready for my lard collection, my leaf fat, and I got like this much, just like a cup from these breeds of pigs that were more commercial breeds. So can you talk through that for just a minute so our listeners know what to expect depending on the breed they have on butcher day?
Sure. I only know from my experience, right? So we never had an issue with limited amounts of subcutaneous fat, back fat. We ran red wattles and old spots. If you're, I can't wait to do it one day, but Mangalitsas is an especially lard heavy, fat heavy breed. So look at some Mangalitsas, but I would say any of your, there's two pieces to it. There's the breed, which I would say any of your standard heritage breeds are going to give you fat, but it's also food. You know, we have a tendency in a homesteader. I was guilty of this too. In a homesteader, you know, it's like, well, let's just let them forage for whatever they can get. And, you know, this is the other side of the coin with pigs. You know, you can't just let them out in the pasture and let them eat their way to fattiness. You got to feed them. Now, if you've got some acorn glens on your homestead, you know, hopefully the acorns come in. But, you know, those last 2 to 3 months of that pig's life, they need to be getting, you know, 4 to 5 pounds of feed from somewhere a day. And so if the forage isn't real robust, you know, part of the problem you may run across, Jill, is there's just not enough calories to pack on the fat, right? And so that's part of the formula. Now again, you can go source if you've got, you know, local breweries or distilleries or anything like that. There's a lot of ways. This is the beauty of pigs, is they can thrive on a lot of different things. But it's a factor of feeding. Feeding is a big component of it. So, those are the breeds I'm aware of. Large blacks. I've run some large blacks. Now they're a little bit more torpedo-y, what you would call a bacon pig. And so, you know, really big, long torpedo like bellies. But I, you know, again, if you're feeding them out and they're getting up to that 300-pound mark at 8 months, you're going to have plenty of fat.
Does that, but like, if I have like a more commercial modern breed, like a Duroc or Hampshire or whatever, like, could I feed them to get more fat? Like, especially like that leaf fat?
Oh, sure.
You think, or?
Well, the leaf fat is visceral fat. Now, if you've ever had a DEXA scan, and I suggest it for folks that are sort of wanting to dig into their own health, but a DEXA scan will show you have this much subcutaneous fat and this much visceral fat. You can encourage visceral fat growth by laziness and overconsumption of calories. It's a little harder, but when we start talking diet and packing on the pounds, whether this is beef, pork, anything, you're really talking about subcutaneous fat. So the kidney fat, let's just say that's set in stone. Now it is a biological growth. So the bigger the pig, the bigger the fat will get. But that's an important distinction. You've got leaf fat, internal kidneys, and then you got all the other fat that's padding that animal. So, and you'll have plenty of that too.
Okay. Interesting. So when you're collecting fat to render into lard, are you separating your sub-Q fat and your visceral fat, or are you just kind of throwing everything in the same bucket for rendering? Okay.
Separate it. Yeah. You want to keep. So we've killed, we've scalded, we've scraped, we've eviscerated, we've hung. It's the next morning. Let's butcher this sucker, right? Okay. So if you're, again, going to encourage the whole ham, you know, look them up, figure out how to cut that whole thing off, get it hanging, get it salted out of the way. If we did the half and half, then you're going to skin out the rest of the animal. And again, this is why you cool it off. So you can grab that skin and get as close to the skin as possible. Cause every cut that you make, that's not just the skin, you're cutting into all those fat stores. So you get that wrapped off, and then you start, you know, with the spine, the chops, all of that, but you're trimming this fat off. Everyone's knows a pork chop, you know, and you've got this fat cap on it. Well, that fat cap is going to be as big as you want it to be for the pork chop, and everything else you trim off is going to be your lard. And so, have your buckets, out for all the various cuts. But yes, you definitely want to keep your leaf fat separate from your back fat.
Okay.
Call it back fat.
Just because.
Yep. And you'll want to render them separately. Now,
explain why. Yeah.
They're different. Okay, so leaf lard, which is the kidney fat, again, this is homesteady. This was prized for baking. So because it doesn't store anything, think biological function, right? A pig will metabolize vitamin D from the sun, and it will store that in its subcutaneous fat. That's lard, okay, which is why lard is amazing. It's not going to store anything environmentally or minerally or... It's just not storing anything in its visceral fat. That fat's purpose is to protect the organs. And so when you render it, it's odorless and colorless. When you heat up leaf lard, now, as soon as you cool it off, it turns, you know, pale white. But when you heat it up, it's slicker than water. Like you can't, it's clear. But from a baking perspective and cooking perspective, it's not going to impart any odor or taste or smell to whatever it is that you're making. So keep it separate.
Okay. Yes.
Separate jars, separate rendering process. Yeah. So you've pulled your leaf fat out. It's over here on the side, you know, in a cooler, right? And then you've trimmed off all of your other back fat, and it's over here to the side. When it comes time to rendering, you just grind that stuff up. I like to grind it. Some people will just chop it, but I like to run it through a grinder and yeah, just put it in a pot with a little bit of water, low heat, a little bit of water, and you render it and just give it time, you know, just be patient. Some people will, there's a recipe out there to like fill your, crock pot, with fat and a little bit of water and just turn it on low and leave it for 24 hours. You come back and you just spoon all that stuff out. Rendering the lard is going to be a little messier than rendering the leaf lard. Leaf lard renders very easily because it's kind of wild. It's this one big globulous piece of fat, right? It's like encased in viscera. And so you grab it and you pull it out and it's this big chunk. So it's like a Tootsie Roll. Okay. You unwrap the Tootsie Roll and that's what you render. And so it's a really big Tootsie Roll.
I mean, it's good though. I got the instant mental image. So you should keep that one. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. So with lard, because it's subcutaneous fat. So you have to think about that fat was layered on over months and months and months. And so it's got a lot more biological cellular material to it. So when you grind it up and render it, you'll have a lot of pork cracklings. We should talk about those. Save them or feed them to your chickens or both. But if you've never made pork crackling cornbread, you are missing out on the finer things in life.
That's intriguing.
And they freeze well. You know, you can vacuum seal them, freeze them. Again, chickens will eat the absolute tar out of pork cracklings, but yes, you'll have very few cracklings in the leaf lard rendering process, just because there's less biological stuff than you will with the lard rendering. And you'll get just for your ratios, every pound of visceral fat, you'll get about a cup of rendered lard on the leaf side, and then about every 2 pounds of back fat is going to give you about a cup of
lard. Because just so there's more of the impurities.
So that sort of speaks to the but I don't like to call them impurities. It's just it's fat and connective tissue and things of that nature. There's just more of that
in
back fat.
Accurate to say that the back fat would have more nutrient qualities because, like you said, it's absorbing vitamin D and all that versus the leaf fat, which is around the organs, or is it similar in nutrition?
I don't know for sure. I know that beef tallow is touted as having high vitamin A and this, that, and the other, and it's the visceral fat from a ruminant animal. My hypothesis, I've never taken stuff to a lab, but my hypothesis is that the lard would be way more, again, it's environmental, right? You raise a healthy, happy, one bad day pig. I'm going to hypothesize that fat is more chocked full of vitamins and minerals than your leaf fat, for sure. Has to be, because that's the vitamin mineral storage organ.
Yes. And that's what I was thinking. I'm sure it'd be hard to get that tested definitively, but it would make sense, like you said. Yeah. Yep. Okay. One of the questions or concerns that I hear a lot from folks is they're worried about the lard tasting piggy or offensive or too strong. And I know we talked about how the leaf fat is going to be milder by nature. Do you have any thoughts for folks who are you doing back fat, you know, that subcutaneous fat, and are concerned about flavors? Just lean into
I'm
the
not.
Flavor.
I mean... Well, it's so mild. I mean, who doesn't brown their chuck roast in bacon drippings? Like, give me a freaking break. We've gotten into this super hyper clean world where, because Crisco, which candidly, I don't even remember what it smells like now. I'm not even sure it's got a smell. It's been so long since I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But we've gotten to this place now where if it has a smell, then that's somehow indicative of not good. And again, people think that lard smells like bacon drippings. It does not. Bacon drippings smell like bacon drippings. And so, don't get me wrong. There is a palpable, especially during the rendering process, there's a palpable odor in the air of fat. I find it wonderful. Once you've cooled it off and it's been in the fridge and it's back to, you know, it's sort of solid state. And it's not in a solid state on your kitchen counter, right? It's liquid. It's viscous, but it's not like tallow where, you know, you've got to dig into it pretty hard at room temperature. Now you put it in the fridge, it'll harden up a little bit. But I don't grow up, people. This is real awesome stuff.
I could rant on this. Yeah. I have actually ranted on this. I think on the podcast or on Instagram where I'm like, y'all, like, their culture is so obsessed with foods not tasting like where they came from. And obviously that can go too far and be offensive or rotten or rancid. But like, now that I'm closer to food after homesteading for over a decade, like I can, like when I drink milk, I know what cows' body odor smells like, not their manure, but I know like what their breath smells like. And I know what a cow smells like. I can smell that and taste it in milk. It's not offensive to me at all. I'm like, it came from a cow. Cool. It should be cow-like. But I'm like, it's not a bad thing. It's an animal product. The same with eggs. Like eggs will taste richer. So I think we just have to readjust our taste buds as a culture.
Well, if you take all the hyper-processed foods out of your diet, and all the additives and all of this, you're going to start tasting. I have pictures. My cousin, he's my dearest cousin. He's a junker antiquer and he's a collector of things. I have pictures. I'll send you one of turn of the century. So this is early 1900s, late 1800s, lard tins. Okay. So everyone's familiar with the holiday bucket of popcorn, like the big popcorn tin. Okay. So I have pictures of tins of lard ranging from 8 pounds to 120 pounds of lard. This is back before refrigeration. This is back before HVAC, any of that stuff. So I want you to imagine for a minute, 120 pound can of lard.
Yes. I found one at our soda fountain in our basement. There was so much junk down there. I found one. It's huge. No. And you could like fit a small child inside. It is ginormous.
Oh, yeah.
And it was lard. It's so cool.
Well, I mean, I store my rendered stuff, you know, before I make cream. I store it in 5 gallon buckets. And those 5 gallon buckets weigh about 40 pounds. So imagining a 120 pound vat of lard pre-refrigeration. So again, like this stuff can sit, it's fat. It's just going to sit there and wait for you to use it.
Which brings me to actually a question I had for you. People are always, I get a ton of emails, they're scared of the storage because we are so used to refrigeration on all the things. I always tell them, I'm like, it's shelf stable, y'all. Just leave it in your pantry. Is that, I can tell them that, right? That's like not bad information. It's not going to go like,
of course. And if it's rancid, you'll know.
So if it does go, because is there an instance where it would go rancid faster? Like if it was rendered, maybe not as thoroughly, could it go rancid more quickly? Or is it kind of just like, eh?
Oh no, I'm glad you brought that up. So in the rendering process, there's one step, especially with lard that I do. The leaf lards, again, it's a little cleaner. So you're rendering. So you got all this, you know, stuff, all the little bits and pieces. So I will, it's almost like double distillation, in the liquor making business. So I will have a colander with a cheesecloth over an empty pot. Okay. And as I'm ladling out my lard, cause you're going to get little bits and pieces, right? Some of the crackling's just going to, so I run it through a cheesecloth, colander, right, to make sure none of the particulate gets in, because that's what's going to spoil.
Okay.
right? If it's pure fat, you're good to go. So yeah, I will take it through that process. And then once I've got it all rendered, you know, I've got a big vat, and then I will, every rendering I'm using two, cheesecloths. And of course I use the reusable washable ones. Right. And so, so I'll do that. I'll get the first run through. And then when it comes time to store, I will run that back through another cheesecloth just to make sure there's no biological material in there. Okay.
That makes sense. And that's what I kind of had that hunch that maybe if you hadn't, if there was stuff in there, that's where it would spoil more quickly. So that makes sense. Yeah.
Yep. And then when you jar it, however you want to store it, again, you can store it in buckets or whatever the case may be. But immediately following rendering, like, don't seal anything, let it cool, because you'll get some condensation. Water is really the thing you don't want in there. And even if it gets in there, it'll just be on the surface. Lord, I've opened plenty of buckets of stuff and there's a little mold on the top, and you just spoon that out and discard it. The fat provides this hermetic.
Oh, that's the word.
That's the word.
Yeah. I know what seal. You're saying. Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah. It seals.
Right.
Right. And so if you got stuff on the top, it's just like that ham, that black, moldy, nasty ham. Well, hell, that's just on the outside. You scrape all that away, and what's inside is this most delicious meat ever. So
I like also what you mentioned earlier, and I think that's a really cool point, how it is so much easier to scoop at room temperature, which sounds like not a big deal, but it is a big deal when you need to use some. Like, I love my tallow. I render tallow, but it is hard, and you have to like soften it or melt it before you dish it out or whatever. And the lard, I just love it because it's in a jar. I just scoop it. It's like Crisco, but better. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And if you're measuring, like so my daughter's birthday is this weekend, and so I made her a cake. And of course, the recipe calls for vegetable oil. No, sir. But so if baking is science, cooking is more suggestion. And so, you know, you got to get those ratios right. I can't imagine trying to, like, you'd have to heat the tallow and pour it into the measuring cup, because you're never going to get close, you know, guessing. And so, the lard, you just dip it on in there. Now, again, if you put it in your fridge, for those that are just absolutely fearful of it going bad, put it in your fridge. But it is going to harden up. Not to the degree tallow does. It's still pretty creamy. But 120-pound can, pre-refrigeration. Yeah.
Amazing.
So there was enough of a market for us to produce 40, 50, and 120-pound cans of this stuff. We didn't have anywhere to refrigerate it.
And it was fine. Yeah, it was fine.
So
fascinating. So totally fine. I just realized we are almost at time. This has flown by. Such a good conversation. We will do
it again. We'll do it again.
Yes.
I'll come on anytime. I love these conversations.
You get so actionable, which I really appreciate. I love getting granular. There's so much broad information out there. When we can give like actual detailed info, it just makes me happy. But we've talked a lot about lard food more, food applications, which is a huge part of it. But I mean, really where you're making waves is the skincare world, which I think, and we talked about this a little bit on the previous time you came on, but that's not something we see lard used in as much. So if someone is interested in creating lard-based skincare, by the way, just shout out, guys, try Pharaoh's lines. They are absolutely fantastic. But if you want to play with it on your own at home, because I know a lot of you are serial DIYers like me, what tips would you have for them?
I would start with leaf lard, as opposed to lard, just in mixing. But, you know, the sky's the limit. Here's what you avoid. Do not, if you go to the Google, don't do emulsifications. Okay. I shouldn't say that. You can emulsify. Listen, the first recipes I ever made after I found out the lard works in mysterious ways, were an emulsification. I used beeswax as my emulsifier, and I emulsified water with lard, and it was luscious, Jill. It was to die for, until 7 days later when it went rancid and turned black.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want to play around, if we've got a big beach party or a pool party and you want to have a nice little lathery thing, then you can make it right then in real time And just know that this is a single use product. So you can play around with emulsifications all you want. I don't do that because I didn't want to get a degree in chemistry and figure out what toxic crap to put in there to keep mold and bacteria from growing. So that's the emulsification side of the house. And again, you can do this in a mixer, you know, just your standard kitchen top mixer. I'm in the fulfillment room of our manufacturing facility right now. And next door is the kitchen. So yeah, get your mixing bowl out, a nice whisk. You can do this by hand if you'd like, if you don't have a stand up electric mixer. But yeah, just play around with it. I mean, you got lard, you got leaf lard, you got tallow, you got any other, various. I like playing with tallows. I'm doing this now. Like I've got some bison tallow. Ooh. It's really hard compared to beef tallow. And so playing with sort of like the ultimate sort of viscosity of the product and ratios and, dump in whatever essential oils you want. If you want to throw some zinc oxide in there and, play around with like a homemade sunscreen, the sky's the limit. It's absolutely, there's no end to what you can do with this stuff in your kitchen, and your skin will never look better because you're going to have it all over you while you're making the stuff. And again, the lard works in mysterious ways.
I did have a question because I know you do mix the tallow into your lard creams. Is it just to create more of that? For a slightly firmer texture? Is that why you're doing that primarily?
Partially, yeah. And, again, my first recipes ever were this emulsified recipe, right? And I was like, oh my God, this is a crazy, amazing. Yeah. And then it went rancid. And so when I fired the water, I started playing with ratios of tallow. Because again, I wanted to try and closely mimic at room temperature a standard cream that you buy at the market. Again, you can play with it, play with your own ratios and formulas and various things. Can you go 100% lard? Of course. Why not?
Sure.
I don't. We'll probably have 100% lard-based cream at some point, but I like the – and even the viscosity of leaf lard to lard is different. Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Leaf lard is a little firmer. It's a little firmer even at room temperature. Just like tallow is firmer than, well, we don't see a lot of rendered beef fat, subcutaneous fat. It's usually used in the grind and all that fun stuff. Okay. But
yeah. So good. And guys, I'll say it one more time. It's the texture is so awesome. Like I put it on this morning. I put it on before I do makeup. I put it on at night before I get into bed. It's just like, it's so creamy. It's like very luxurious. And it's like this whole like routine. And I'm like, it's just funny. It's pig fat, but it's so luxurious. So if you're feeling a little bit of ick factor, don't. There is no ick factor. It is amazing.
There's no ick factor in awesome skin results.
Yes.
There's no ick factor there. And for your listeners, I will say, it's not hard for ladies. It's a little hard to get over the lard situation. For guys, it's a little harder to get over the wait, I have a skincare routine thing. But I personal experience, I have not had razor burn in about 3 years. And ladies for the legs or whatever, wherever you decide to shave, it's helpful. But I do think that speaks to men. I got a really nasty scratch in jiu-jitsu about 3 weeks ago and just did a like everyday photo of lathering up and, there's no scarring, no nothing. So this stuff is amazing. Again,
one of those natural products people have been using forever and we went and complicated it. Thank you, Industrial Revolution, with seed oils and all these crazy formulations. And I'm like, just go back to the basics, guys. It's so much simpler. And your skin will thank you. Yeah. All right. Remind everyone where they can find you and where they can get in touch with Pharaoh Skincare and order some of this for themselves.
Sure. Our website is pharaoh.life. I have another web address for your listeners if they want. If they will go to lardforthewin.com and give us their email address. We will send them a discount code. for their first purchase. And the reason I developed another website is because nobody knows how to spell Pharaoh.
Oh,
I get the P-H-A-R-O, you know, Egyptian, and it's pharaoh.life. Okay. But yeah, lardforthewin.com. You know, we're on Instagram. You can look us up on Instagram, Twitter, and all that fun stuff. But that's the best spot to find us. And yeah, if they go there, they'll get a nice little coupon for their first purchase. So thank you for
absolutely. For that, yes. Jill. Well, thank you, Charles. I think we enlightened the listeners. I think we definitely annoyed PETA. If they even listen, they probably don't listen anymore, because I think I probably annoyed them a long time ago. But thank you. I think this was such a fun follow up to last time, and I look forward to having you on again.
I would love the opportunity to talk pork and homesteading and all the things. So we'll have to figure out a fun topic for next. And thank you again, Jill.